Hello and welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wabo's most popular work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we are back to talk about False Moves 12.6, 12.7, and what's this? An extra material. It's been so long, Elliot. But the delights of the extra materials have, at least for this week, returned, and we'll be talking about that as well.
Yeah, I think they've become a bit few and far between as, like, Wabo's been focusing on, like, the story hitting, like, the major stuff. I've almost, like, back in the day, the default was we'd get an extra material. And now it's like when I see one, I'm like, oh, holy shit, yes.
Yeah, it's like a little treat.
Yeah.
Speaking of a little treat, these chapters, Elliot, you sent me a message after you had finished reading the latest one, just being like, holy shit, these chapters are so hype. And I'm pretty sure I sent you a message, that same exact message,
the week before.
Like 3 or 4 days ago, yeah. God, the story at the moment is really just top notch. Like, obviously we are fans of this story at all times, but holy shit, these chapters have been really killing it. So I'm really excited to talk about them.
No, we're explicitly entering like the end game now, and everything's firing on all cylinders at the moment. Yeah,
it is. God, it's so narratively satisfying how having everything start to pay off. You know, we've been talking for a while about like, oh, the BHI has got to come back into the story somehow, right?
Yeah.
All the things, this is like the perfect example. Everything's just coming back. Oh, the witch hunters, blah, blah. Like, it's all just crashing together in that way that just feels so good. So yeah, should we get into it?
Let's do it.
All right, first off, False Moves 12.6, we're in Avery's head. We're picking up from the cliffhanger of 12.5. Avery and the Kenneteers are in Charles's dream, and he's confessing. Although for somebody confessing, he is being very evasive.
I mean, I almost get the impression a lot of that is just because he can't do anything right. He's not allowed to do anything right.
So let's talk about this, because is your read on this that he actually can't do anything right, or just people treat him like he can't do anything right? Because he's just like, when I say he's being evasive, I mean, he's giving these answers that are just so shitty. And like, you wanted to confess, Charles, don't be like this. Like, I don't know.
I definitely relate to the thing of like, when you're talking about something you feel so guilty about, like the big takeaway from this is like, Charles is carrying this with him a lot.
Yeah.
And I get that, like, when it's on you like that, you struggle to get to the point and you kind of flub it when you get there. I think part of it, I think it's one of those things. I feel like if there's a chance for him to sort of fuck it up and he's heading in that direction, karma kind of smooths the
push.
Yeah. And I mean, just like as a device, I love that we sort of have karma sitting over us. And like sometimes the Kenneteers break away and they're like, he can lie to us, but also, you know, is our karma biasing him against it? Like, even in the one character who can just lie to us, there's still a twist. Like, this story doesn't just be like, oh, he's just like every character in every other story. Like, there's still a thing on him that makes us, like, have to question what we're hearing from him and how we're feeling about it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I really like how this chapter starts as well as a way to kind of remind us of that. We get this bit where Avery basically thinks to herself, let's not pay too much attention to what Charles is saying, but because we're in his head, let's just examine that space so that we can get a picture of him outside of the potential lies that he is telling. I think that's just a great kind of clever thing for Avery to be doing, to just be like, damn, that's really smart, Avery. Yeah.
I was like, oh, holy shit. But I think we talked about this last week. It's one of those things where, in retrospect, I'm like, oh, of course you're going to do that. That makes so much sense.
Yeah, you're interrogating someone inside their brains. There's a bunch of, like, context clues that you can get about whether they're being truthful with you. It's great.
And we've spent, like, most of this arc being trained in the concept of these people's dreams reflect who they are and what they're thinking.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like Avery said this at the start of the chapter, and I was like, fucking, of course. Like, obvious. It creates this great dynamic of like, that lets Lucy focus on sort of being this lead interrogator. Verona kind of backs her up and, you know, also like touches on the lore and just is a bit of a smart ass. And then like Avery gets, as the third person, she gets a bit more freedom to just like wander around and inspect the dream. Yeah, it's such a really cool... I could almost see this being one of the early scenes Wild Bow pictured for the trio, like when the story was still forming in his head. This like perfect scene of like you have like Lucy sort of charging down the interrogation and wanting to get the answers from the suspect. Verona kind of backing her up while also like bringing in the left field ideas associated with that. And then Avery just running around the perimeter seeing what else she can uncover.
Yeah, keeping an eye on them and keeping an eye on the situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. You'd have to imagine Wilbo is thinking of these kinds of scenes when he's coming up with the idea for this stuff, because these are the really juicy things, like the setup of these three kids interrogating literally a broken man, right? Like,
yeah.
It's just such a juicy scene. Like, these are the scenes that feel like they play so well in the theater of the mind, or you can see in a film adaptation or whatever, as being like the scenes that people will walk away from the story with.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
I guess all of the, you know, confronting the culprit scenes have been like that. They've all been very different, but all very, very compelling in their own interesting ways.
Yeah, yeah, that's a really good point. And yeah, just like, the framing device of a dream, and Charles can lie, but he kind of doesn't. And also, I think he tells us he has a bad memory, so it's like some of his lies could just be unintentional. Like some of the minor discrepancies, like it, you know, when you watch for words, as we've been trained to do by the rest of this story with Charles, if you notice a tiny slip up in the terminology he used, it could just be because he's shit now.
And
the dream setting itself, I love how everything is cut glass around him. Like, it, the universe is literally throwing him into like the thing that, like, Alexander hurt himself by stepping on broken glass, didn't he? So it's like this dream is him literally being haunted by that one moment, the moment where he got forsworn.
Yeah. Yeah. It's brutal. Great. And obviously, I mean, the whole point of what Charles is saying here is my whole life has been defined by the mistake that I've made, even to the extent that it's the reason that I'm a culprit, right? And the reason how I've become a culprit. I thought it was really funny. One of the dodges that Charles does, which I thought was really interesting, was he says, "Before I get to that, I do want to say I'm afraid I can't be hospitable. I don't have any food or drink." And Lucy calls this out as Charles stalling, which maybe it is, but also just kind of like the fact that Charles's hospitality is what got him into the situation he's in. So of course he thinks to mention like, "Hey, just so you know, I can't be hospitable." I just found that really funny.
Yeah, I find myself wondering if that is a dark joke he's telling.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, like, he's in the scene of him losing everything for not being hospitable, yeah.
Yeah, I just thought it was very funny that he says that, and Lucy's so dismissive of it, but I was like, I think it's fine that Charles mentions this, because it's like his whole deal.
Yeah, it's fair enough that this is a chip on his shoulder. Wait, what's interesting about Charles's dream, though, is I almost get the impression it might be a little bit like just the way it's so punishing. At first I was like, oh, maybe that's more just the universe punishing him. Like, it's his dreams. Mm-hmm. Like, the universe, even in his dreams, he can't escape. He doesn't even get his dreams.
Yeah.
But at this point, he's so broken. I could almost, like, that's one and the same thing, right? Like, everyone else's dreams showed them and what they were worrying about and what they're thinking about. And at first I was like, oh, Charles doesn't even get that. His dream is the universe shoving this mistake in his face. But the more we talk to him, the more I'm like, he's doing that to himself too. Like, it's the same thing. He and the universe has taught him to shove this in his own face now.
Yeah. I think it's interesting to keep that in mind, especially because his involvement in the Hungry Choir and his lack of, like, coming forward earlier and stuff is him continuing to wallow in this mistake, right? Like,
yeah,
he refuses to let himself be free from that, even if it, I mean, not be free from it, like, even confessing would be some form of catharsis for him that he seems to be so refusing to let himself have.
Yeah, and we're going to go into that a lot more today, I think, because that's essentially this whole chapter and a half. But it's a great point in that he's been so broken by this, and that's like almost the only thing you can blame him for at this point, in my opinion, and I still can't bring myself to do it.
What is not coming forward with this?
Yeah, and not doing more to help. Like, that seems to be what the Kenneteers at least hold against him the most. Yeah. But I understand why he was broken in the situation he was in.
Yeah, I can almost understand, and we might get to this later a bit, but I can almost understand him not coming forward before the Hungry Choir was taken down more. After the Hungry Choir was taken down, and his plan clearly couldn't pan out in any possible way, then it's just selfishness from him, right? Like, there's no moral argument that he can make.
He does sort of get into it later in a very roundabout way. I can't remember where my notes are for that, so we'll get back to this later.
Okay, cool. Charles confesses to creating the Hungry Choir. Effectively, I mean, there's a lot to talk about, and it's all pretty tied up in Charles's confession here, but
yeah.
he created it as a way to get back at other practitioners, but it got warped by the Carmine Beast, and so that's why he's involved in this conspiracy. He wanted to create this to get back at the gang. The Carmine Beast got in the way, and so he tried to take that and use it to get revenge against the Carmine as just his, I guess, payback for that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, you could also argue that, like, at that point, trying to stop the person who unleashed the Hungry Choir on the world is, like, an altruistic...
Yeah, I suppose.
But, yeah, that's a whole separate thing. Just even, I think, discussing the ethics of what he was trying to make is interesting. Like, basically, he wanted to create a trap for Alexanders and Bristow, something that promised you power, but you had to sacrifice yourself to win that power, which I don't know if that means you don't actually die or, like, you know, the power has to go to, you know, your loved ones or your next in line or whatever. But it definitely reminded me a little bit of that idea of, you know, like the Bristow test we've talked about. Like, do you want to sit at the top if it's not you who can sit there? Like, exactly. The Toad's Law and Bristow. Yeah, like Charles's logic. There is some valid logic to this idea of, like, presenting this prize of, like, you can have this if it's not for you.
Yeah, unlimited power, but only to the person who doesn't want it, right?
Yeah.
Which I think was an argument we made when Ray was put in charge of the BHI temporarily, was the fact that he doesn't want it makes him, at the moment, the most appealing candidate.
Yeah, and like that, you know, the seeking power has been a huge thing in this story. So yeah, like, I find it so interesting. Like, I could see people backing Charles's what do you call it? The red heron
inveiglement. Yeah.
I'm not sure how to say that word. Like, Lucy has her own thoughts on it that we can get into next chapter, but, like, I could see someone backing this idea and me not immediately writing them off. Like, compared to the Hungry Choir. Like, I think people who are like, we needed the Hungry Choir, I'm sort of like, yeah, fuck off. Whereas I think the red heron thing is a little bit more, I'm like, okay, I can see he's trying to do something good. It's a shitty way of doing it, but also at the time, that's all Charles had.
Yeah, I mean, the thing he was trying to do was effectively make a trap that would get rid of the worst types of practitioners, which is obviously something that we, at least in theory, agree with.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not so keen on the murder and all that, but like, yeah, some of the core principles are sound.
Yeah.
Some of.
Yeah. But yeah, it's pretty messed up. It got inverted in the worst possible ways, and then just became this thing that started feeding on innocence. And Charles lost any potential moral argument that he could have made.
See, Charles doesn't lose anything there to me. Like, that's not Charles's fault. Like,
well, yeah, I suppose. The fact that he, before, when the Kenneteers were ready to go up against the Hungry Choir, remember there was times when they didn't know it was Yolda, when they had all these missing bits of information that really helped them take it out. Charles knew that the whole time, right? So that's definitely on him. Yes, he didn't want it to be this, but he allowed it to happen.
Yeah, I think we're circling back now to the idea. Like, my argument for why he hasn't spoken up before now is, I think he did want some things to go through, and also he's just a bit broken. I think he probably felt like if he did try to help, it would make things worse.
Yeah.
And I think he's wrong, but I think it's very fair for him to think that now. I find myself unable to begrudge the dude for thinking that if he tried to help the Kenneteers, it would make things worse for them.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I get that argument, but I'm not as much of a Charles apologist as you are, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Would it be better if he didn't, if he wasn't like that? Yes. Is it reasonable that he's ended up like that? To me, yes.
Mm.
But yeah, he gets into later. There were also, yeah, he wanted all of this plan to succeed to some degree.
And that was
part of his motivation. That part is shitty, and he should be in trouble for that.
I want to call something out here, because I think it was a really good point that was made here by a user who made a post on the Parahuman subreddit. The user was Sengachi. This is a post from a few days ago. And I just thought it was really interesting, and I want to bring it up. I don't know if you've read the post, but basically about the Probably idea not. That the Carmine Beast gave Charles his own version of this test, effectively. I just thought it was very interesting. Did you see this post?
I did, yes. Yeah.
So the brief explanation is Charles wanted to give practitioners a choice of, you know, sacrificing yourself for the good of the many, effectively, is what they boil it down to, which I think is maybe a slight oversimplification, but effectively correct.
Yeah.
And then Charles is presented with that choice and explicitly wrangles with that choice when we see some of his notes in the next chapter, but doesn't do what he wanted to set up as the test for the other practitioners. And Sengachi says that this was an explicit test given by the Carmine, but even if it's not, even if it's just some narrative trickery by Wapo, like, man, it's so nice to think that and be like, oh shit, Charles, you're such a fucking hypocrite.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it was like an explicit test by the Carmine, but I do think it was very intentional by Walbo to throw in the stuff next chapter being like, yeah, see, look, Charles thought about sacrificing himself and ultimately didn't.
Yeah.
And again, his part of his logic for that was the time he was going to try to do it, everyone died before he could.
Yeah, the first time he was going to try to do it.
But there was never
another time that he tried to do it.
Yeah, which comes into all this stuff of like how broken he is, how valid it is that he's broken or whatever. But like, because the other side to that I think ties in is he kind of makes that play in this chapter. He offers to take the fall for everything here. He's like, say it was all me, like all the Carmine shit, put it all on me. Which, I mean,
it's not untrue.
Yeah, but it's certainly taking the fall for a lot of other people who I would argue are more culpable than he is for where things are right now.
Sure.
And that is very much him. Like Avery argues for it next chapter. It kind of just allows them a bit of a get out of jail free card by putting it all on him. Mm. So he does in a way live up to it to a degree with that offer, but he's certainly struggled to get there himself.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And he is presenting that now, when, you know, there really isn't another choice. He's effectively caught. Like, you know, now doing the altruistic thing means nothing.
So, to go back to what you said, just about the way the Hungry Choir was like totally twisted out of all the opposites of what he wanted.
Mm.
Like, we just have to call out just what a like absurdly extreme example this is of like everything that's wrong with like punitive justice and just the way that the world of the otherverse works in general. Like just like, and Charles directly calls this out. He's like, the Carmine and the system helped release this thing that's killed hundreds of innocent people just to say fuck you to me. Mm. What a crazy example of the worst extreme of punitive justice, where it's like, in order to punish Charles, we will kill hundreds of innocent people so that he feels it. Like, what are you talking about? That is it's the stupidest shit. Like, the most frustrating thing about this whole situation is like, I'm even angrier at the Carmine. Part of me almost wants to say I'm glad she's dead, because what a fucking idiot she was. Like, seriously.
It almost makes no sense, doesn't it, Elliot? Like, the Carmine does this thing, gets a lot of innocents killed, and then eventually dies kind of poetically to this same thing that it has helped create. It almost is too neat, don't you think? And here we get to my theory. So some of the pieces that don't quite fit here are raised in this chapter, right? Like, why does the Carmine let itself get killed? Why did the Carmine allow so many like innocents to die? That seems like it's a lapse in its duty. Why did it go to the arena? Like, there's all this stuff that doesn't quite add up.
Yeah, and that all sort of, we get reminded that those are still open questions in this chapter. Like, this chapter is like, hey, remember, these things are weird, right?
So here's my theory. I think the Carmine Beast is still alive, or at least has a more active role in this conspiracy than we previously thought. That will answer some of these questions, as well as answer what I don't think is a question, but a sentiment that a lot of people are feeling, which is like, hey, we're learning so much about these judges, these three judges that we know, and it seems like they're being set up to play a role in the finale. So is one of them going to end up being a culprit? And that has never really felt narratively satisfying to me. But something that would satisfy that and be much, much more consistent is if the Carmine Beast becomes part of the finale, right? And I just, it just feels like it answers a bunch of questions of weird lingering bits. The one downside to this theory to me is it would imply the Carmine Beast had a almost Joker-esque Machiavellian plan of all these pieces falling into place, which I think is a bit over the top and probably won't happen.
But, you know the thought it put in my head was, so what if the Carmine Beast realized the Hungry Choir was destined to kill it? So it set up a thing where it could get killed, but not quite, so it can come back to life. That's right, Pirates 4, baby.
Sure. basically, what I think the Carmine Beast is, I think the Carmine Beast has lost a huge amount of its power, obviously, and is now living out, and this is going to, I swear this is going to sound like a fucking shitpost, but it's not, is now a much smaller, reduced form, on the same size as, but not necessarily, Jerry Pop. like, I know that sounds like I'm shitposting with this theory, but I genuinely think this theory, this Carmine Beast is now a very small thing that we don't necessarily know what it is. We might not have even seen it before, but some very small creature that is intending to reclaim its furs at some point and thus its power when its plan has come to some sort of fruition. So that's my theory. Feels like it answers a lot of the lingering bits. I don't think Charles, Mariska, or Edith know that that's going on, but I think it is. I'm staking it.
Interesting. Okay. I wonder, like, I was trying to think, like, I'm always trying to tie this back to some of the real world metaphors, and I'm wondering, like, what that, like, how that might map to a real world sort of situation. I'm drawing a blank now, but I'm also not the most well versed in political or legal stuff.
There's possibly themes of, like, of just kind of the shittiness of the modern world of, like, big powers just setting up chaotic conflicts for their own meaningless ends, you know?
Because why has she done this?
I don't have an answer to that, no.
Yeah, okay.
No, so
I was just wondering, like, what if this was her way of quitting the job? Like, what if there is a little Carmine running around now? She's joined the private sector, you know? Like,
She wanted out for some reason.
Yeah, took
maybe
a quick kick back from someone. She's working for some practitioner, making cushy money.
Again, maybe she's just genuinely living out her life as Cherry Pop now, and that's totally chill. Because obviously another piece of this puzzle is that Charles has said that the furs are now being fashioned into to fit somebody small, right? Cherry Pop's pretty small.
Yep. That's true. It's canon.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, wait, just to go back to Carmi, like, what? Like, fuck you for creating the Hungry Choir. I think I've already said that. I just want to say it one more time. Like, I can't get over what a shit move that is.
Yeah, no, I agree. It genuinely feels like it doesn't. Like, there's more to it. Because surely the Carmine Beast should at least somewhat be against the idea of just murdering a bunch of, getting a bunch of innocents murdered.
Well, I think,
I guess because it's set up as a test, that's not as much of a thing.
Yeah, well, I guess, to be fair, something in the extra material, I think, helps to clarify it. Like, I don't think the Carmine Beast was physically there, right? Like, this would be, like, a result of her ambient stuff.
Yeah.
So, like, almost what it's saying is, like, this is just the system she built and supports. So it's less, like, I guess, a personal attack on, she made this judgment and you know, she's a cunt. It's like, she created the system where this is the sort of thing that happens and it's considered good and right.
Mm.
And so just like, fuck you for that, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, Edith gets a shout out mention here for being like a selfish asshole, and just as shit started to go crazy, she used the bit of claim she had to just be like, protect Kennet, keep us safe if you're going to murder innocents, which is just very on brand for her.
Yep. I mean, like,
This thing's going to go around killing innocent people. Well, protect us while you do it. Okay, thanks.
Yeah. I mean, I can even imagine a world where, you know, if the Hungry Choir is already a misinterpretation, that misinterpretation could have been interpreting hunger in a way that meant that it would map to Matthew's emptiness more. So think Edith probably did well to save Matthew's life in that scenario.
And the other thing I keep coming back to with all this is, like, we're learning so much about what was going on and all the people involved, and I just keep coming back to the idea, like, Guillaume must have had his finger in these pies at some point, right? Like, you know, maybe never as a culprit, maybe always working against them, but, like, how deep in the sand must his head have been to have, like, missed all this?
Yeah, you know what else hurts to think about is I feel the same way about Miss. I suspect we're going to find out that Miss has known a large proportion of this the entire time.
Yeah, I think she, like, early on in the story, she never, like, would...
Well, she said she knew. Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess just...
That's pretty damning to me as well.
Yeah, like, I guess with Guillaume, he had other stuff going on or whatever, but I just, like, it's, like, either way for him at this point, either he knew some stuff and didn't say it, which, like, dickhead, or he didn't know, in which case it's just kind of like, oh, like, so shit hasn't been good for you for a while. Because, like, Marisica managed to get all this shit in line. Like, if you didn't, that's not good for you.
Mm. Yeah.
So, as you mentioned, Charles said the furs would be for someone small.
Yeah.
So you're putting your vote in on Tiny Carmine?
I mean, yeah, / Cherry Pop. I think Snowdrop is also an interesting thought of, like... Because Totoro has talked about making Snowdrop at least a figurehead leader, and I think it would make sense for that to be something that other conspirators have been thinking about. So I don't know.
Yeah, my thought was actually Toad Swallow himself, as like just because we've had a few beats about how he and Marisica are weirdly friends, and both of them kind of agree on a lot of this Fey Goblin nonsense being bullshit that they don't want to quite conform to. So I could see Marisica's big brain plan that nobody sees coming is to put a goblin in charge like that, in a way that also kind of means he wouldn't be able to do his whole, like, market plan at the same time.
Yeah.
But the thing that fucks that over, like, every time I try to think of someone in Can We Talk About the Girls, one of the callers seemed under the impression they would put on the furs.
Yeah. Interesting.
Which, like... The only logical explanation I can come up with for that is that person's Charles, and this whole thing is like a red herring, a lie he's throwing out there.
Mm.
But
yeah. Mm. Yeah. How small is small, I guess? You have to be pretty small.
Yeah. It covers like half the cast is the problem. Basically, it means not Guillaume, really.
Mm.
Not Matt.
Mm.
What I do like is like this idea that that Charles sort of touches on is that the point of the plan seems to have been that the culprit, or Marisica mostly, wants to create a scenario where the furs being donned isn't really a secret.
Mm.
But that, like, it seems like it was never meant to be a thing of, like, John takes the mantle and then, like, you know, the curtain sweeps aside and reveals, you know, so-and-so in the
Marisica with the furs ready to... Yeah, supplant him.
But the thing I'd never thought about was this idea that Marisica wanted to contrive a scenario where, like, the council would sort of get together and be like, oh shit, X needs to put on the furs or all this bad stuff will happen. And that finally explains why, once the culprits realized the Kenneteers had the furs, they didn't care anymore, because as long as the furs are still there for them to pull that play, they've still got all the pieces they need.
Yeah, but, like, I don't know. And that also explains why Marisica went to the BHI, because this is the exact kind of scenario where that could happen. Do you think it will happen? Do you think that's the right move?
I feel like, yeah, we'll probably get at least close to the situation where
a Kenneteer might have to put on the furs.
Or not just a Kenneteer. I'm even thinking, like, you know, yeah, it could be something like, because again, there's that, can we talk about the girls person who seemed to think they were putting on the first? So like, you know, is Mariska trying to contrive a scenario where everyone agrees Charles or whatever should put on the furs?
Mm.
And I can't picture what that looks like. Yeah, so I'm kind of hoping it does happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. I won't, like, this is one of those things where I'm like, I can't imagine it. So like, prove me wrong, Wabo sort of situations.
Yeah.
But that's just the vibe I got from what Charles says here is, yeah, putting on the furs, it isn't meant to happen in secret. The point is they want everyone to say, oh shit, you put on the furs.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know.
Yolda's still alive, technically. She's small.
Interesting.
Throw on some spaghetti at the wall on that one. I'll take credit for it if it goes anywhere.
I like that one. Now that I think about it, I do quite like it. It's pretty horrifying, huh?
She just came back to town.
Yeah, shit. Good call, Elliot. Ooh, that's a good tinfoil.
Yeah, it's definitely tinfoil.
Mm. Interesting. Anyway, so in the story, the Kenneteers and Charles head to another nightmare to just kind of take a breather, I guess. It's Verona's nightmare, though, so things get real bad real quick.
Yeah, like this nightmare overtook the conspiracy for me and like my focus. Like, I'd almost been skimming over the parts where Avery was going through Charles's nightmares details, because like, I don't care, I want to know like what Charles is saying. And that kind of inverted for me here. Like, this nightmare is such a good set piece that I almost like, I was almost switching over to like, shut up Charles, I want to get back to the weird shit in the nightmare.
Yeah, it's crazy how horrifying Verona's nightmare gets, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's a great representation of the fact that Verona is very good at bottling down some really powerful emotional shit. Like, this is strong enough to effectively overpower her, Charles, and Lucy. So stuff gets wild.
Yeah, I mean, she's the master of bottling shit up, right? Yeah. So, like, her subconscious, yeah, it must look like a pressure cooker. Especially what I love about this is, like, because her winks and nods seem to much more be generally drawing from this idea of, like, rewriting past encounters to just pull like your worst read and make it textual or whatever. It pulls in more from the others than we've seen any other dream do. Like, you know, Olivia starts colliding with Avery.
Yeah.
You know, I think Raymond comes up, and then as Charles sort of asks, oh, what are you gonna do about that? It's like, bam, Declan and her dad show up. I think like Lucy's mom barely shows up at the start because it's not really bad memories associated there until the dream can twist it to her being hurt. It takes all the ideas that cross their mind and like brings up shitty memories that kind of dump on that part of who they are. It's a really fun dream that affects all of them in a cool way.
Yeah, man, isn't it fun? Yeah.
Yeah.
Really fucks with them.
Yeah, and just the way like it tied into what was happening at the time, I thought was really cool. Like, as you could see a character's thought process move somewhere, suddenly they'd quite literally be tackled by, like, you know, a bad memory associated with that same feeling. Like, whenever Avery was thinking about, like, connections and friendship sort of stuff, that's when Olivia would run into her. It was great.
Yeah.
Also, Avery manages to use that stupid knife she's still carrying for some reason.
She pulls out all the gear this chapter. It's good stuff.
It's just funny because she pulls out the knife and uses Lucy's tear to like empower it to kill Brett, which is this really emotional, it's this super great poetic moment that probably has more power because this is the other verse, but in any other universe, I'm just looking at this and being like, could have saved a step just with a regular knife, Avery. But I love, there's like this detail where like when Brett dies, he bursts into confetti. which I was just like, okay, that's a little cue from Verona's subconscious there, I think.
Yeah. Yes.
There's another moment I just want to quickly call out. There's like a great bit where like Verona's dad is carrying her away and she like tries to like resist and she's like, no, I want to talk to Charles. And I was just like, even the universe has to admit that like as bad as Charles could possibly be, Verona wants to talk to him over her dad. Like, even the universe isn't going to pretend that Charles is more or less appealing as a conversationalist than Verona's dad to her.
Yeah. Even the universe can't make that argument.
Yeah.
This nightmare is pretty horrifying, but luckily the Kenneteers soon escape into a not-so-bad nightmare, the Forest Ribbon Trail. They're walking and talking with Charles, and Avery is acting as effectively their walkthrough, their game guide.
Yeah. We'll touch on Avery and the Forest Ribbon Trail in a bit. This was so much more the proper Forest Ribbon Trail than I expected going in. I kind of thought it would be like this fun, dreamy, or not fun, but like, you know, like there'd be twists and stuff. Like, they actually are like following the Forest Ribbon Trail's rules.
Mm.
And I was like, is that really necessary?
Yeah. It's weird, isn't it?
I think we'll get into that a bit in our notes. But we've got to talk about this thing because like, Charles is obviously still explaining stuff as we're jumping through nightmares. Mm. And this is the part where he kind of makes one of the central metaphors of the world of the Otherverse very textual. I think we've like talked about it here before, but basically the whole thing with the truth telling and the rules of discourse is basically everyone in this universe agrees, hey, you have to do this and you have to say this and it has to be true. Otherwise, you're shit and you get punished.
Mm.
And basically Charles directly maps that to the idea of, or Avery might do part of it in her head, but the story finally just straight up maps that to the idea of like contracts and law to an extent, and just sort of says, if all contracts stop mattering, like if people don't have to tell the truth in this world, then all the other shit that like all the other, you know, little blocks holding the world together just completely fall apart and the Jenga tower crumbles.
Mm-hmm.
And like, cause you can make the same case for the legal system in the world. Like the legal system only has power because enough of society is willing to enforce it that it has power.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you start to take away like some things like contracts, how do you stop the whole thing from falling down? And that's basically like what Charles raises here is like, how can we change some of the fundamentals of the system without bringing the whole thing down? And he's just decided bringing the whole thing down will work in the meantime, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, tear it down and start again is not the worst option.
Yeah, it's arguably better than letting it persist.
Yeah. But everyone always wants to try and find the perfect solution, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we talked about this like back in, you know, arcs 3 and 4. Like we talked about like the idea of like the culprits just being anarchists, like they want to, and that's essentially what still is being, it's still essentially the case being made here, is the system is broken and these guys just want to completely tear it down to try and build something better up after it, but like that involves a lot of collateral damage and doesn't really guarantee that you will build something better. If you create a shit environment, it's a bit naive to think that the perfect legal system will just arise out of it.
I
just thought it was interesting that like as we sort of head into the end game, the story is very much like, if you haven't picked up on what this is a metaphor for yet, like here you go. It's the legal system, it's contracts, it's like back.
This segment, something that stood out really to me as well is like Charles is not cool and collected here at all, right?
No.
And I think that's really interesting because he's like getting upset and he's trying to like, I mean, he's not able to, but he's trying to at least make some stabs towards justifying his actions and all this stuff that's like really makes me think he's being pretty honest here. Like either he's a really good liar or he's getting so impassioned and like whiny and everything about this that it has to at least be mostly true what he's saying, right?
Yeah, ever since reading it, I've kind of been working off the assumption that we're getting like at least 90% the truth here.
Mm.
And I'll even go a bit further to say for all the important details, we're getting essentially the truth. He's lying about these little things like the fact that he still had some resources at his cabin or whatever.
Mm.
But I think most of the story about the origin of the Hungry Choir, a lot of his motivations, you're right, it just rings true because it's a good lie if it's a lie because it doesn't make him exonerated. Like it puts him in a really bad spot still, even if it's a lie. Like he's not dressing it up much if it's a lie.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, 100%. It's at least mostly true.
I like... yeah, this is where some more of the stuff comes in with, like he, I think this is really the part where he's basically justifying why he's broken and why he stopped trying. Like, he's sort of saying, whenever I try to do something, it gets worse.
Mm.
And I'm just kind of inclined to sympathize and understand with that mentality. Like, even if I am disappointed that's where he's ended up, it's still just like, whenever he tries things, it makes it worse. And whether that's true, whether it's just he's being allowed to think it, if it's both, like, whatever. He kind of gets to this point here where he's like, my read on things is that the Hungry Choir would kill the Carmine and things would get chaotic and the old system might get torn down and it would be bloody and bad. And it's not a good way of doing it, but it'll happen and that's better than nothing. And I've resigned myself to just being part of that. And, you know, that's what I see as him being like, this is why I haven't owned up. He's sort of saying, I still kind of want this to happen because I don't think any other alternatives will succeed and this is better than nothing.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I get what you're saying. It feels pretty empty to me. It feels pretty hollow.
Because he is.
Well, sure. That's fair. yeah. Yeah. Fair enough, I suppose.
I mean, as like Charles, because Charles, like, he talks about here, he's sort of like, yeah, he says what we have sort of said for a while as well, which is like, everyone around here seems to want the same kind of thing, which is, the system is bad, we need to change it. And obviously what they all disagree on is exactly how and what to change. Yeah, Charles sort of turns that into a, well, this will tear everything down, that's better than nothing argument, I think. Whereas he does ask us to question, what does Miss and Rook's solution look like? And this is similar to what you brought up with the Carmine thing as well. This is the story just reminding us, hey, here's a question you don't know the answer to yet. Like, what the fuck are these two aiming for exactly? They're the same as everyone. Their general motivation is the seal needs at least an amendment. How are they looking to achieve something like that? And I still, yeah. I don't have an answer.
Well, so the answer that we get is they want the Kenneteers to become lords, right?
He implies that. I think. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I guess it kind of makes sense as a plan. It's a bit of a wild one because that would. Well, maybe it wouldn't have big reach. I always feel like Lord, such a big word that makes me feel like, you know, everyone at the BHI would come down and contest it. But maybe it's not that big a deal if they're the Lords of Kennet.
Yeah, we haven't actually seen a Lord. So I don't know, like, a lot of the nuance of what a Lord is missing for us because we don't know what they are in practice. We've been told, but we haven't seen it in action. Like, we were missing some of the nuance, but
yeah.
Again, instilling practitioners as the lords, there has to be like a next step. Like, they have to want something out of the Kenneteers as the lords. That can't be the end game because that's, you know, putting in a benevolent dictatorship in your local area is not a long-term strategy.
Yeah, you're right. It's not.
Yeah. These two are thinking long-term. So like, if that is part of their plan, that is a step. And I'm wondering what they would ask of the Kenneteers as lords to do. To help set whatever precedent Miss is trying to set.
I mean, maybe the precedent is have lords that are more ingratiated with the other and innocent community. I could kind of see that as being a precedent they want to set that makes more sense, like almost a democracy, but it's not perfect, is it?
Yeah, I suppose if you made the Kenneteers lords and then made them just re-implement the council as lords, like made it the lords' official decree that, you know, kind of like I'm thinking of like England, right? Where they still technically have the royal family, but the royal family has seceded all of the actual power to the house and to, like, to the parliament. Like, maybe that's the goal. Maybe they want a lord in power who says the others and like everyone else can actually make the decisions. I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I can see that. I can see that kind of working, right?
Yeah, like, yeah, aiming for democracy by basically instilling a lord and then having that lord say, this should belong to the people.
Yeah, exactly.
And it would make sense because we're looking for something cutting edge, but in this world, 400 years old is pretty cutting edge.
So, yeah, they reach the end of the path and the Carmine Wolf appears feasting on Charles. While the others wake up, Avery heads back to Charles's nightmare to poke around a bit.
Which, wow, we'll get back to that in a sec. But yeah, let's talk about the wolf, I think.
Yeah, man, the wolf is so strange, right? Like, because we're inside a nightmare right now, and I'm just kind of like, but the wolf feels very real and feels very much like itself. And so it just kind of makes me feel like, if they bumped into the wolf in the FRT again, would it know all of this stuff? Or, you know, at the promenade, would it know that this had happened? Or is this like only inside Avery's set? But then Avery talks about the paths being closer to dreams and how she can kind of get back to Charles's one, and that kind of makes sense. And that implies to me this is the real wolf, right? Like the paths just are close enough to dreams that this can happen.
I agree. I came out of this chapter feeling like, I was like, okay, that feels like it's meant to be the wolf, like actually the wolf, which I wouldn't have expected. But yeah, for whatever reason, the way the chapter is structured and it's worded, I was like, that feels like it's meant to be the wolf. And like, it makes sense to me. Like, you know, like we've talked about the dreams part and paths relationship stuff a lot in the past. I have to admit, I had like that big theory in like early Arc 7 on sort of the cosmos of the Otherverse and how the paths related into it. And I've forgotten exactly what parts of my head canon and what is canon, because so far everything else that's been canon has more or less exactly aligned with it. So now I'm losing track of what are the details I came up with back then and what are the ones that have actually been confirmed. Like if you think about the paths and lost things as like stuff right on the outskirts of this sort of thoughtscape of the universe, they're kind of churning a little bit in the unconsciousness of the universe, and like so it makes sense that like in dreams, like I wouldn't be surprised if dreams are how a lot of things end up being lost, like things that get discarded by winks and nods and stuff, like when your subconscious decides you no longer need something, that's how it gets lost. So like just the idea of like, you know, dreams being how we sort of recycle the bottom stuff that we're not really dealing with, that's what the paths kind of are cosmically. So like they would be linked conceptually through that. Makes sense. And this is all my lead up to my big theory of the week, to follow on from yours, which is like, I do think that this is the wolf. And I think I've finally got a theory as to how the wolf fits into all this and like how it all comes together. Cause you know, we keep talking about like the wolf feels like it has to be involved somehow, but none of it makes sense.
Yeah.
And I want to say I came up with this theory before the extra material came out, and then the extra material only reinforced it to me.
Okay.
I think the wolf is using Avery as an anchor to draw at least herself, but probably a good chunk of the Forest Ribbon Trail into the real world, like to get found. So yeah, basically I think like the wolf has talked up her connection to Avery sort of since early on. And I think this is all a big brain wolf plan to get an anchor into Earth, to get more touched by the Earth and basically try to bring, at least herself or some other parts into Earth and become unlost. The extra material, I think, reinforces this with basically just straight up talking about not only does this happen, but also that you can just find things touched by the Earth on the paths. So I definitely took that as like evidence that I should think that this is something that can happen. And it also brings up the interesting point, which is like, if the wolf does do this, like if the wolf uses Avery as a platform to enter the real world, she would have to settle into a form. Does that mean she'd pick Avery's if Avery is her conduit for doing this? Like that'll be,
I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And the way we got it again in the EM, they talk about how knotted places kind of attract one another. As Ken gets more knotted, it would get easier. Like I'm just basically picturing, we're going to talk later about how the end of next chapter sets up just what an absolute clusterfuck Kennet is about to turn into. And I think the meteor that Avery's talking about at the end of the EM is going to be the wolf fucking crash landing into reality just when we don't need it.
I like it, but I think there's a problem with it, which is I don't think that's... I don't know if I feel like if there's enough space in this story for that to happen and it to be not connected to the murder of the Carmine Beast, I guess is my problem with it.
I guess I don't tie it to the murder much myself. Yeah. Like the way I tried to tie it into my head before this was assuming that like either the Kenneteers or the culprits would do this on purpose, like bring the wolf in as a weapon. Like, as you know, as an alternative to the witch hunters, you could see the Kenneteers being like, why don't we just send the wolf at Musa?
Yeah.
But I think this could tie in very specifically to Avery's journey as like somebody who was always reaching out, like the wolf kind of using her and dragging her down. And like maybe the wolf's going to try and replace her. Maybe there's another angle where at some point Avery's going to get a bit lost. Again, that does not help with the how do we fit that in part that you mentioned. But I think this won't tie into the mystery at all. I think this is going to be the sort of climax of Avery's journey, and it will tie into the clusterfuck of the rest of Kennet, but it's going to kind of be the culmination of Avery's whole thing with reaching out and having bad people drag her down and stuff.
Maybe, I hate to say it, maybe Miss is involved in this somehow. Maybe that's how it ties into our conspiracy. I mean, I've always kind of felt like Miss has always been more suspicious than she should be. So maybe that's a way to tie it in.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know. I don't see it, but you're certainly not the first person to posit that Miss and the wolf are involved in shit together or whatever. Mm. Yeah, I don't know. I'm just picturing this as like, I can kind of see it just fitting in Avery's story now, but in a way that explodes out into everything else that would make sense to me.
Yeah, I can see it. Interesting. But so yeah, to get back to it, Avery is, you know, poking around inside Charles's brain, and Alpie finds her and is like, hey, this isn't on. Wakes her up, but Avery manages to steal some stuff from Charles's brain before she's kicked out, which is interesting. And uses that to find this cabin and evidence and clues and such.
Yeah, and we've got to talk about the morality of that, right? Well, honestly, what I'm more interested in talking about is the fact that the Kenneteers don't even really question it. Like, I think we get one throwaway line towards the end of 12.7 where Lucy's like, I'd rather, you know, snoop around in his head and steal shit as a punishment than do, I think it's, she's talking about having him self-sacrifice or something. But I was just like, that to me felt like it had to be the karma that the Kenneteers don't even really seem to say, oh, should we have done this? Because I'm not going to argue that it was the worst idea. Like I think there's merit in maybe doing this and you know.
They found that Charles was hiding stuff from them. So clearly it at least had some, like I would feel more critical of it if it hadn't worked, you know, if it hadn't been necessary.
But I guess just like thinking back to the Lucy who, you know, with all the stuff with Edith was so careful to make sure they were doing everything like due process.
The idea that feels like that's slipping away, doesn't it?
Yeah. Like there's no talk of like, yeah, should we feel comfortable doing this? And I feel like with every other character there has been, like, even if ultimately I ended up agreeing that this was the right thing to do, I'm uncomfortable with the fact they didn't seem to have a conversation about whether that was okay. I don't know. A search warrant, for lack of a better word, may have been valid. And I think, yeah, given all the stuff with Charles and the fact he can lie, there is an argument for this being the right call, as much of an invasion of privacy as it is. I can't get over how concerning it is that they didn't talk that out that like that. Avery just does it. And then the other two are like, oh yeah, good idea. It's like, what?
You're right. It is in a lot of ways, a breach of, I don't know, something, morals, privacy.
Yeah, it feels like a huge invasion of privacy. And like, given whatever, like, even after what Charles has done, and I guess with everything he's gone through, like, even with those aside or whatever, that it still like feels like a weird violation to just start creeping into people's memories and nicking stuff. Like, I don't know, I don't care what they've done. I feel like there needs to be, that's something that needs to be talked out.
Yeah. Interesting. But yeah, so they find this cabin and Avery has pulled some sneaky stuff and found some stuff. And we'll get to that next chapter, I suppose.
Although I love how she wakes up in her house and she has to check it's not still a dream because everything's so quiet that she thinks something's wrong.
Yeah, good moment. Yeah, definitely. We'll get into 12.7 now. We're in Lucy's perspective, and Lucy, Verona chit-chat as they're planning ways to get out and about without being, you know, double-grounded. I'm glad Wabo lets us know. As soon as Wabo mentioned there was a fake Verona that was Snowdrop running around, I think he knew that he would have to let us see it or risk a huge mutiny, so I'm glad he's chosen the path of no violence.
Yeah, you're right. Like, the second I saw that, I was like, if we don't see this in story at some point, I'm going to be very upset.
Yeah, exactly.
It's also great because, like, you know, obviously we've just talked about 12.6 for a long time, and there's a lot in it. But in many ways, it's a very intense and kind of, you know, negative chapter. Like, it gives us a lot of info and does a lot of stuff, but it's a draining chapter in a lot of ways. Like, with all that info, with how glum Charles's life is, I certainly came out of 12.6 being like, oh, geez, fuck, like, I need a bit of a break. I think 12.7 opening with this is very much Wildbo just being like, okay, let's pick things back up a little bit.
Yeah, let's give everyone a bit of a respite from all the trauma of Verona's nightmare high school.
Yeah, well, and especially as, you know, we're heading into the end game, that's not going to be pleasant. Like,
yeah.
These are these sorts of shining light chapters that we're going to really start to treasure as we just dive down into the mess of the final conflict.
Yeah.
I pulled myself down to just pulling one quote from this section, which was very hard because there's so many good ones. There's a part where Lucy asks Snowdrop what she was doing last night, and Snowdrop sort of says, I wasn't browsing opossum pictures or anything. I watched a movie about cars. And there's all this conversation around that about how, like, weird her rule of discourse makes everything she say be, and it's all hilarious. But this line just jumped out to me because I'm like, the fuck is an opposite of a car? Or, like, is it a movie about not cars?
Yeah, my first thought was it was a different Pixar movie, like Planes. but yeah, who knows?
I'm just like, I almost read the bit where she pauses and says, I almost want to think that's not Snowdrop. That's the spirits hearing whatever she said and thinking, how the fuck do we make it the opposite
that? Of
yeah, yeah, God, Planes is honestly, I can't come up with anything better than that.
Like, yeah.
I just, yeah, great little Snowdrop line to make me just sort of pause for a second and be like, what? What's the opposite of a car? Well, what's the opposite of being about cars? Was it about walking?
Yeah. Or maybe about getting hit by a car?
Yeah.
Like she was watching YouTube footage of car crashes? I don't know. Yeah, just a movie that doesn't have a car in it. She was watching a movie about, I don't know, she was watching a movie set in caveman times. So yeah, Lucy draws a big connection dampener, I guess we can call it, and the trio head out in their bird forms to go and meet with the tag on Kenneteer, Avery, who, you know, I think would make a good fourth Kenneteer, but, you know, that's maybe controversial.
Oh yeah, that one. I always forget about her.
Everyone's least favorite. Oh, sorry, Avery.
I love Avery, but it's just, it, like, she so often just ends up on her own, and I love that she's getting to a place now where she, like, accepts that that's her thing and is kind of doing it on purpose, but, like, I just can't help but, like, notice and get a bit of a chuckle out of every time Avery's off by herself doing her own thing and just thinking, God, previous Avery would have hated this. Can we talk about the rune that Lucy draws here? Because obviously this is another great section, extra rune or like all that stuff we talked about a dozen times now, I think. But this rune that Lucy draws does this interesting thing where she doesn't just block the connection like they normally would, but she, like, as you say, kind of, she masks it. So, like, Jasmine, when she thinks of them, she will still think of them and just kind of get the false impression that they're there.
Yeah. There's, like, sounds that will play of just them hanging out in their room chit-chatting and stuff.
Yeah, which is, like, first of all, that's lying. I know it's not with their words, so it doesn't count. You can't force someone, but, like, this is lying. But, like, I guess what just sort of jumped out to me were, like, two things. First of all, in some ways, that almost feels like it's more of a betrayal of the trust than just blocking the connection. Aside from that, I was just like, is there bounce back from this rune as well? Because something the early story really hammered in for us was, like, if you keep using the connection blockers, after they expire, things overcorrect. And so, like, you know, Verona will get extra attention from her dad because of all the connection blockers. Is there going to be something like that for these? Like, is the opposite, like, what I was thinking is maybe Jasmine gets this feeling that they're not around and that they're unhappy when they are just around and fine. And she's going to, like, you know, that'll just manifest as her, like, keeping a closer eye on them still. But like, yeah, I just wonder if that nuance will be reflected in some potential bounce back.
Yeah, I don't know what that would look like. It's a weird one.
Especially from a narrative perspective, I wonder why else Wabo would decide to include it. Like, is it just a neat extra thing, or is this, yeah, leading up to some, I don't know, slight nuance in the way Jasmine treats them?
Yeah, I wonder.
Also, they all turn into birds, and I just wanted to call out, like, so Snowdrop wanted to be a seagull at first, which I was like, oh, fuck, that does feel perfect for her.
Yeah.
But then I remembered, and this is a very Australian reference, but, like, thank God Canada doesn't have ibises.
Yeah, as soon as you wrote that, as soon as I saw that in the notes, I was like, oh, shit, that's so perfect. Snowdrop would be a perfect ibis. It's basically what she's like already. I mean, can you imagine if this story took place in Australia, Snowdrop would be an ibis instead of an opossum, and it would just be great. And can you imagine the shirts an ibis would wear? It would be delightful.
Yeah, you'd barely have to change her character to make her an ibis, really.
Yeah.
I think in my live read, I linked to, you know, that song about ibises.
No.
I'll put it like in our Discord after this. So doofmedia.com/Discord if you want to see it. There's a great thing for people outside of Australia who don't know what an ibis is. This is a great video that shows off what you need to know about ibises and how they're basically just winged opossums.
Yeah, 100%. What were we talking about?
So the Kedeteers are trying to leave, they're getting ready to leave Lucy's place. There's a great moment where where Jasmine's like, okay, are you going to be good? And Verona's sort of like, yeah, we'll keep our heads down. We'll be good. We'll stay put unless we have to leave in the event of a fire or a dramatic or magical incursion of wizards and monsters and stuff like that. And like, this is the point where Jasmine's sort of like, oh, are you okay? And I just love this moment because Lucy and Verona just spent the first third of this chapter giving shit to Snowdrop for how she talked with her rule of discourse. And then Verona comes down and the first thing out of her mouth is just like her shitty Gainset attempt to be clever just reads as a wild Snowdrop thing where it's like such a stupidly specific denial.
Verona's always been a bit too clever for her own good. So yeah. This kind of stuff definitely is great.
Yeah, like the idea that like she's just sort of saying, oh yeah, Snowdrop made Jasmine worried. She comes down, basically sounds just like Snowdrop, and Jasmine's just straight back to, are you okay?
Good stuff. The gang gather at Charles's old domain, and Avery runs them through what she's found so far. They go through Charles's things, and the trio discuss plans for dealing with the upcoming BHI meeting.
Yeah, and this to me felt like another scene where I wouldn't be surprised if Wildbo said, like, this was a scene he had in his head before he started writing Pale.
Mm.
Because Avery uses her sight in such a cool detective way here. Like, this is one of, or this is by far the coolest she's used her sight specifically to fit into the sort of motif of the murder mystery that I could just so easily believe this was planned before the story started, because like she's using the connections to fucking walk us through what happened on the crime scene. Like it's like a better version of a fucking CSI where we're walking through and she's like picking at connections and being like, so this shows us that Matthew and Edith were here for this long. And I'm just picturing CSI with like little yellow tags like as they're walking through a crime scene and the forensic guy goes through it. It's so cool.
Yeah it's cool stuff, isn't it? I love all these, crime procedurally kind of moments. They're just always so fun in this story.
Yeah, and we haven't really seen Avery excel at doing that until this point. So it was really cool to see her use, like, her sight, in a way, is kind of crazy powerful, like, with those connections. Like, the fact that she can find some cigarette butts and tie that to, like, where Matthew and Edith were hanging out years ago or whatever is, like, that's cool as hell and powerful. Like, yeah, I almost was a bit disappointed. This is only a small section of this chapter, and we don't get to see like Avery having a cool like forensics mastermind moment for half a chapter at least.
The sight stuff, as she's developed her finder skills, being able to do things like see through Snow's sight as well, and all that jazz. It's really cool. It's really fun.
Yeah, it's a good point, and that probably helped her as well. Actually, I forget, like, because Snowdrops is perhaps the most bluntly just a really handy detective site, because it just helps you find things that are slipping through the cracks. Like,
mm.
it's almost textually, hey, here's a clue that's going to slip past you. As well, like, they have this whole debate about should we just let Charles be the scapegoat? And I just wanted to call out this little conversation because Avery is very willing to have them consider it. Like, she very much takes the position of, hey, we need to discuss the possibility of just giving Charles up.
Yes.
And this felt like another one for me where I was like, karma has to be a play on this one, because even with all this stuff going on, I just can't believe Avery's at the point where she wants to consider just giving away Charles and calling it a day.
But that is kind of what they do, and I feel like it's the right move. I was surprised that you were so against this for Avery. I don't know. Like, there was nothing here that she did that I thought was over the line.
Well, they definitely turned it into the much more nuanced and, in my opinion, like, acceptable take of, like, they get him to admit to his crime for, like, the crimes he actually did.
Yeah.
And they sort of use that as leverage, or it kind of ends up being anti-leverage in the end. But I got the impression at this point she's talking about just saying, oh, if we just say Charles did all of it and let him take the fall for all of it so that Musa can, like, tie up his neat bow, shouldn't we at least consider that? And that, like, I was shocked that any of them would consider it, really.
I don't know. It's a pretty nice get out of jail free card. I think it's worth considering. He did do the crime.
Well, I don't, I don't think he did.
What, like, they would the lie they would be saying is that he, what would be the lie in that, right? That he was more behind some of the later stuff than he was?
And especially if Musa's coming for all the Alexander stuff, like, I think they were talking about potentially tying him into that.
Yeah, that obviously would be a lie. But it didn't sound like they were going to frame Charles for Alexander's death. I don't know.
That,
like,
was the impression I had, that was a conversation they were having, is should we consider doing this?
But I don't think there's a way that that conversation goes where John isn't asked, did you kill Alexander, right? Like,
yeah.
And that's really, like, there's no way they're going to let John take the fall for it. So no matter what Charles admitted to, it probably isn't going to get them off the hook that much for the Alexander stuff.
Yeah, well, I'm not saying it seemed like a good plan. I was just I was just surprised that it seemed like they were even like all three of them seemed at some to some degree willing to entertain the possibility of just handing Charles to Musa or whoever and seeing how it works. And Avery pulls the Avery pulls the whole Verona logic of, like, okay, well, how can we make this a plan we're morally okay with? And I think they get there. I'm really happy with what they ended up doing. It was just a shock to me that, like, it almost didn't start there. It's like, is there a way we can do this that works? And instead, Avery's almost just kind of like, I don't know, should we give him up?
Yeah, fair enough, I suppose.
The other part from this section that I think is worth talking about is, so Lucy and Verona have this sort of moment. I don't know exactly what words to use to describe it. Like, I felt so sorry for Lucy in amongst all this with, like, the way it sort of starts is Lucy thinks, oh, you know, Avery's quite easy to read. Like, she's quite honest about what emotions she's feeling. Like, she doesn't say them, but you can look at her and sort of, you know, say, oh, she's struggling, but she's coping and she's okay. And then she looks to Verona and just sort of thinks for the about billionth time in this story, the fuck is going on in Verona's head? And I just, like, you see her sort of just, she just wants to help Verona and be part of her and be part of her life or whatever. And she, like, it's just not there. Like, Verona's not willing to let her to a degree. I don't know. Like, they eventually get to this point where, like, she manages to walk on eggshells to sort of get Verona the message that, hey,
Jeremy hasn't got the picture.
Well, yeah, basically. Or basically just sort of saying, hey, just so you know, Wallace seems surprised that you two aren't dating, which maybe means Jeremy is under the impression you kind of are now. Maybe it's worth reaffirming those boundaries.
Yeah, which is obviously a good point to raise.
We've been yelling at Verona to do that for arcs now, but I guess it was just like, for me, it was like, thank fuck that she finally got that through, but also, like, it's very concerning that it was so hard to do. Like Lucy had to be so careful in the way she did it. And it just, like, continues to reinforce to me, like, Verona is still really recovering from what her dad has done to, like, her concept of, like, vulnerability and how okay it is. And so she's not at all willing to be vulnerable and open this stuff with Lucy at all. and that's going to continue to hurt, like, well, both of them, but like Verona as well.
Mm.
And, you know, like, there's so, like, we, I think we talked about this a lot last week. There's so many reasons. I get why Verona is, like, quite uptight about it. And, like, you know, but, like, just, you can see when she's at the point where she, I think she said Jasmine nagged her about it. And I was like, that is not my read of what Jasmine was doing last week. Like, I, like, if Verona is so churned up and in sort of insecure about all of this to the point where she said what Jasmine was doing is nagging, I'm just very worried about how Verona is coping with all this. I really felt for Lucy, and I was just like, oh, Verona, you need to start letting other people in, or it's going to be a problem.
Yeah, I understand that she feels that she has done her due diligence there, but it just is pretty clear that Jeremy hasn't got that picture to a large extent, right? And just,
yeah,
I don't know. She's being very defensive about it, but the fact is, it still just feels like it's going to end badly. And I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know. Maybe that's unavoidable. Maybe that's just unavoidable.
Yeah, and I do still think, unless I'm just not remembering the times, which is very likely, my memory is dog shit, I also don't think this has ever really been properly explained to Lucy to the point where she should understand it. So no, yeah, like, it's just Verona with the Jeremy thing. It's almost she didn't get to explain it well because she has no role models, and I'm like, that was tough. Whereas with the Lucy stuff, it feels like it's almost 50% that and 50% this stuff with her dad preventing her from being okay with communicating it, which has left this gap. And it's just like, it's just going to keep hurting them both. It's frustrating. And like, we see it again a bit when they talk about, like who could be potentially going into the Carmine role. Like, they talk about the Carmine Doe, the Carmine Fox. And Verona won't even talk about why she could be eligible as the Carmine Cat. And Lucy's sort of like, can we talk about it later? And Verona's like, yeah, maybe if we have to.
Yeah. She's not great at communicating this kind of stuff, is she?
No, she's, you know, we saw it in her dream. Like, she's bottling shit up, and yeah, she can't even be vulnerable and open about this stuff with, like, Lucy and Avery. Like, she's going to be in trouble.
So yeah, the trio fly back to Kennet, and the meeting of the BHI peeps and the Kennet others begins. Oh God, it's tense.
Yeah, and that tension is immediately ratcheted up by Rook showing up. Because I feel like that's the thing, like, Rook shows up and everyone's like, wait, you're coming to the meeting with the practitioners? And she's like, yeah, this is big business. And I felt like I was sort of like, oh shit, this is big business.
Yeah. Yeah, Rook being there at a council event, pretty big indicator that something's going on.
Yeah, and it sounds like pretty much everyone who matters is there, except apparently Guillaume. There's a line where
weird,
Lucy,
right?
Yeah, Lucy seems to note that it's a glamour copy, but it's not, like, made explicit. Like, she never thinks that's a glamour copy. She just, like, there's these kind of sentences which very much gave me that impression, and I'm just like, okay, so if Guillaume sent a copy of himself and he's off doing other shit, what could he possibly be doing? And, like, you know, I guess to go back to the earlier comments about, like, him and the Carmine conspiracy, at the very least, since the trio have awoken, you have to assume he's had schemes in the work. And I have no idea what they are, what his goals with them are. Like, just another thing to watch out for the rest of Arc 12 and for Arc 13 is, like, when is Guillaume's, all the shit Guillaume threw in the sky, when's that going to come crashing down on us?
Yeah, it's so weird that Guillaume's, I don't know what it means. Is Guillaume, it's vague enough, and Lucy doesn't comment on it enough, that I almost think we're just misinterpreting it, and what it means is, like, Guillaume's not here, he's not all here in the head or something, you know? It's very strange to me.
Yeah, that was my read at first. Like, the first time I sort of read that, I was like, oh, Guillaume's really out of it, he's really winterfied. And then I read it again, and I was like, no, actually, I feel like Lucy is saying here that this is just straight up not Guillaume. It's a bit vague. It could be either. If it is a copy of Guillaume, what is the real one up to is a big question.
Yeah. Yeah, God knows.
Like, you know, the fact that the witch hunt, like the fact that the witch hunters are getting called in absolutely feels like it could be part of a plot of Guillaume's. Right? Because, like, you know, he got Raph involved, and it feels like then learning that was part of his plan. But, like, you know, it didn't take a genius to figure out that the Blue Heron Institute people would be here eventually. I think even Charles said that. So, like, Gilame setting up the witch hunters to be nearby
mm.
is within the realm of like fairy string pulling bullshittery that I could believe it.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe.
So like, that's part of his plan. Is that where he is? Like, is he doing stuff to help ensure that can happen? Or is it, or is he thinking a couple of steps ahead now that that's probably happening? Yeah, fuck knows.
Mm.
Or is it just him and I'm making mountains out of molehills?
Yeah, maybe. I feel like because Lucy thinks on it but doesn't think on it enough to give us a clear picture of what's actually going on, I feel like it could just actually be nothing and we're reading so much into this one or two lines.
Yeah, yeah. It's not made explicit, which is why it stood out to me as weird.
Mm.
And then I just want to call out, before we get into, like, the actual shit, there's again, Wabo throws us two nice little bones of joy before we get into the bullshit with Musa. First of all, Lucy manages to quickly think that she wants John to be her familiar. He says it's important she does all the little things, and she says she wants him to be there for those little things.
Mm.
And she wants him to be his familiar. She doesn't get to say it out loud, but fuck it, who cares? That's step one, right? Like, it's coming back.
Yeah, I mean, we're getting there, right? There's been a few of these hints that they will end up together, I guess, yeah, is the way to put it.
I continue to be thrilled by, like, the idea that they'll overcome Alexander's last bullshit.
Yeah, their bond is so strong it can beat Alexander's fuckery.
Yeah, can reform or whatever. And then, yeah, the other bit of good news we get is that Jess has come because she found her cousin, and that was just a very heartwarming, like, that has been her whole deal since before we knew her. And, like, everyone just notes how much better she looks for it. Like, just, like, you know, that sense of mental relief has, like, you know, come in physically as well. She just looks like a different person. Like, yeah.
Yeah, and she didn't even bother to mention it. Oh, she's so awkward.
That is a great moment where she's like, why would I tell you it's my cousin's thing? And then Zed's like, why would I tell you it's her thing?
Yeah. Good stuff.
Yeah. So, yeah, just a pair of really nice, heartwarming moments.
Yeah. Before we get into the real shit. So, yeah. First up, Charles. The Kenneteers confess for Charles, I guess.
Yeah.
Hand over his supplies, pass him to Ray's custody, and you know, give his stuff to them so that they can maybe be used to help Bree out.
Yep. And, yeah, as we said, this feels like a pretty good solution to me. Bree gets all the notes on, like, what the Hungry Choir was meant to be, which will hopefully help her deal with what's inside of her. That's a plus. Ray taking responsibility for Charles kind of feels like fair to both of them. Like, it's an opportunity for Ray to make up for the fact that he just enabled people like Alexander in the past. And I think Charles being at the mercy of somebody he was trying to put under with the Red Heron inveiglement or whatever, and an old friend who was one of his better ones, it just feels good for him. Yeah, I really like this.
Mm.
So presumably, and now he can hang out with Seth at the Blue Heron Institute.
Because
Nicolette is Ray's new apprentice, right? So it's like,
yeah,
now apprentice and master.
They talk about how Bristow was a collector, Alexander Meyer would want to collect nascent gods. Nicolette, hot on the heels, collecting Forsworn practitioners.
It's not the most valuable power source, or even a power source.
What if the twist is that Nicolette is really abusive to them, and that's how she's getting power?
What do you want? That's a that's a terrible twist.
Can you imagine how horrible that would be? The idea of what I find very funny.
I mean, like, the thing with Nicolette is that's not totally out of the realm of possibility. Like, as much as I love her and she's done a lot of good stuff, she's had her moments. Like, remember she had the blood from, like, the crazy people and stuff, and, like, one of them she knew personally and had, like, given to Bristow. Like, she's had her moments of, Nicolette, what are you doing?
Mm.
So I'd like to think she's better than that, but, like, it wouldn't totally ruin my world perspective if I found out just occasionally she'd had to do something mean to Seth to get by for a bit.
Yeah.
I hate it, but
I mean, the more realistic and thing is probably that in exchange for keeping Seth and now potentially Charles safe, she, either with their consent or without it, is kind of extracting power from them somehow by doing something that the universe would give her power for, you know?
It's an interesting twist on Bristow's whole relation. Like, at what point is she, like, because that sounds good to me. Like, even if she's taking a bit from them, I'm still like, well, fuck, it's better than what most Forsworn get.
Mm.
But that was Bristow's argument about the Aware too, so it's interesting to learn where I draw the line.
That's also kind of more or less what the Kennet others have been doing, right? Like, Charles's role in Kennet has been to be the punching bag, and that helps. That, because the universe wants him to be a punching bag, that kind of helps.
Yeah, good point. Good point. We used to complain about that. It's been so long that I forgot we even used to judge them a bit for that. But yeah, you're right.
We already talked about this a bit, I guess, but there's a bit where Charles says, in reference to the notes they've taken, I thought if you had them, you'd unravel things. Which, Charles, you've already confessed. Why would you not just give them the notes at this point? I still don't fully understand. I like Charles's motivations to me, post Hungry Choir being taken out, feel very selfish, but whatever.
Yeah, I think he still wants this plan to succeed to some degree. And I think he sort of barely touches on it because he's trying not to admit it. But like, yeah, the impression I got after my second read was that like, yeah, there is a part of Charles who's still kind of egging Maristica's plan on, and he doesn't fully want it to be unraveled. I think he just wants out of it personally. He wants him taken out of the plan, but he doesn't want the plan to fall apart.
Mm.
Is almost the impression I get.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, Charles, you're a piece of shit. So he gets handed over, and Musa enters the stage to talk about Alexander's death. Unhappy with the snarky responses he gets, he decides he's going to march on Kennet and effectively declares war? That feels harsh, but it's also true.
It's in terms of hype levels, that's what he did for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, as you said, there's a couple of great zingers in this part where like John admits to killing Alexander and then like just is so brazen with like, you know, well, you know, he was coming at us, and there's a great line where he's like, he intended to weaken us, and so I was in my rights to weaken him. And Moose is like, he shot the man in the head. And John's like, yeah, it left him very weak.
It's a really great line. There are some really good lines in here. This is one of my favorites. And then you pulled out the other one that I was going to pull out. So
yeah. Just the other one where Verona's like, I'm not admitting any blame or anything from Alexander, but an awful lot of blue hair and headmasters die around us.
And so do you want to be another one of them? Yeah. Which is really the zinger to me.
Yeah, the implied threat there is just like, holy shit, Verona, like fucking titanium ovaries. Like, holy crap.
It's good shit.
There's also, like, I think a low-key really good part of that line is, like, she follows that up by saying, yeah, do you really want to be another of them? This feels dumb. Which, like, her saying this feels dumb, isn't that, like, word for word what got her entangled with Bristow? She said what he was doing was dumb, and he challenged that. That was how the bet started. Like, she, this is almost a bit of a bait line.
A callback to, as well, yeah.
Yeah, like, every part of this, I was just like, Jesus Christ, Verona. Like, especially now that she's gainsaid, maybe she wants to gainsay him, just get some power. Like, yeah.
Yeah. So that's good stuff. So yeah, things are really popping off.
Yeah. I just want to quickly like talk about who has come along. Because like, as well as, what's Mr. Musa's name? Musa Senior?
Mm.
Do we remember his first name?
We
do know it. Fuck.
I know we know it. I just can't think of it. I always just referred to him as Musa.
Yeah, which I can't do that because Reed is here, his son. Mm. Sorry, I'm just trying to Google it. No, okay, never mind. Musa Senior's, yeah, so Musa Senior's obviously here, and we'll talk about him. Reed is here just as he's kind of eternal number two. And then Y is also here, and it feels like all three of them, you get the vibe, they don't actually really care.
Mm.
They're here out of a sense of like, this is what needs to happen.
Mm.
Like, maybe we'll learn more about why, and I'm being a bit unfair to him, but just based on what I remember of like Borrowed Eyes, why seemed like a better person than Alexander and someone who's hopefully doing better with the role as head Bellinger. Like,
yeah,
I kind of want to like why, which is why my best case scenario for him being here is just this sense of like, he just feels like he needs to do this so that he can tell everyone, oh, I sorted out what happened with Alexander's death. Mm. The person who actually kind of scares me the most in a way for being here, and who I gets one quick mention is Raquel has showed up. And since it's been a while, like, so Raquel was the Musa that the Kenneteers engaged with the most. And her whole thing is because she's a woman, she can't actually be let into the family. But she's trying desperately to prove herself so that they'll make an exception. And, like, that's what's scary to me is presumably she leveraged the fact that she knows the Kenneteers to get her ticket on this journey. And I would not be surprised if Raquel sees this as her one chance. If she can clinch the win in this and prove herself here, that is presumably the best chance she's ever going to get promoted and accepted into the family. And so in a way, Raquel scares me the most because while the other three are probably very powerful, they're just going to kind of be walking around and only fight you when you get in their way. Raquel is going to be going out of her way to do damage and help get the win so that she can justify getting a promotion. And yeah. So that's why she's, I think, low-key the scariest member
Dangerous.
Of this quartet.
Yeah, I can see it. Yeah, I think there's she has more to, not to lose, actually, to gain here than the others.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And like, we've seen Musa, that's the thing, like I think it came up in late Arc 7. Musa said when she wasn't around, oh, Raquel will never get promoted. She's a woman. That doesn't happen. But she wasn't there for that. And I remember being so mad that like Lucy hadn't lent her her earring or something because I was like, fuck, we need, like, Raquel is a nice person. We need to let her know she's dedicating her life to something that's shit and she's not going to get. And I hope the Kenneteers can get that through before she really does something in this upcoming war. She's the one who, yeah, despite having the least ammunition, I'm worried she's going to go the most crazy with it.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess we'll have to see. I do. I mean, she's one of the characters that we saw at the BHI that maybe there's like a sliver of something we can rescue in there, though. So I don't know.
Yeah, I was devastated when we left the Blue Heron Institute and hadn't like saved her from wanting to go into her family.
Yeah.
So maybe that's on the one hand, I'm glad. Yeah, I'm glad we get another chance. I'm also worried what she's going to do in the meantime. Because if her whole life has been building up to getting into the family, this is her chance to do it. That's terrifying.
Yeah. But it's also a chance to break free of it. So maybe we'll see.
Fingers crossed.
Hey, what about this, Elliot? On the subject of like horrifying twists that we don't want to see, what happens if John and Lucy do the familiar ritual in this conflict, and then a Musa comes in and steals John as Lucy's familiar?
Oh fuck! Oh, I want to see that so bad.
It would be so bad. It would be the worst thing I've ever thought of. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but like, but as a reader, Wabo, don't you want it?
Jinx. Like, if Wabo, if you were thinking of doing that, I'd call you jinxed. You can't write it until I buy you a Coke or whatever the rules of Jinx are.
See, I would think this could tie into like Verona's attempt to claim a domain or something, maybe. But yeah, either way, because we do get this explicit thing where Musa's just like, "Oh, also I collect domains," which like stood out to me as a like,
"Yeah,
okay, why are we pulling that out specifically? Is that leading into anything?"
Yeah, into Verona's domain claim potentially.
Yeah.
Wait,
maybe that's the thing. Maybe he, like, maybe because there's got to be limits to him being able to just steal. Like domains, implements, and familiars. Maybe he's got to steal them during
the ritual. Claims or something. Yeah,
yeah. Like maybe he has some ability to, like, because I think we got told in the domain thing you get to challenge it. So yeah, maybe he can interrupt the rituals and kind of turn them his side. And then it turns into this battle of wills for who gets them. That could be really cool.
Interesting.
Anyway,
so yeah, Team Kennet agrees in their defense to launch the only plan that they have, unleash the witch hunters on the town at the same time. The practitioners will hopefully fight the witch hunters, and then bada bing, bada boom, something. Question mark, question mark, question mark, profit.
I mean, yeah, it's like, I fucking love this plan. It's so hype because it's like, this is really starting to hit that sense of the finale that we talked about. Everything's coming together. Like, all the loose threads, except maybe like Clem and Bristow's crew, who I guess I think are probably getting their own story at this point. So makes sense that they don't need to come into this one. But yeah, like Rook even talks about, hey, this will probably bring Marisica out of hiding. Like this is the chaos she'll need to act in. And it's just like, oh fuck, this is going to be the finale and it's going to be huge. And there's all the little things we haven't even talked about yet. Like the, remember Guillaume told us about those fairy anima things, the like fake fairy animals.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like those will probably pop in at some point. Like there's going to be, like, you know, Rook always talks about the chessboard or whatever. This is going to be like a 10 by 10 chessboard with fucking 300 pieces piled onto it. Like I can't wait.
Yeah. The thing that was interesting to me about this, especially as we're thinking about like how Guillaume's obvious susness will play in here, like maybe this is why Guillaume brought the witch hunter in, so that this town would already be a bit on the radar, and the next time they call in witch hunters, they'll really send in the cavalry in case they need this kind of thing to happen. I could kind of see that being part of Guillaume's plan back when he was more of a, you know, non-winter soldier.
Oh, even as a winter fairy, that seems, yeah. Like, you know, I totally agree.
Could be cool. But yeah, I mean, Mussa being set up as the next opponent, possibly the final, or the, I guess penultimate opponent before the real showdown. I think it's very exciting stuff.
Yeah, or at least like I think some of these conflicts will overlap. Like I don't think there's going to be there's not necessarily going to be the distinct fight against Mussa, then fight against like Marisica or whatever, right? Like it might all blend together a little bit. But you're right, like Mussa he's just such a perfect final boss for at least the Blue Heron like practitionery side of the story. Because, like, Kennet's biggest strength and, like, the Kenneteer's biggest strength since day one has been the versatility. Like, we've always talked about, like, the Kenneteer's part of their strength is the fact that they've got fairy toolkit and goblin toolkit and a dog of war. Like, the fact that they have all these tools has been their biggest strength. And Mussa is the same. He's got all these implements, all these familiars, all these domains. And, like, with Reed compounding that, like, he is the same kind of versatility. Ideologically, he's the exact opposite. Like Kennet and the Kenneteers stand for everyone coming and working together, whereas Mussa stands for like subjugating everyone else's people under him. So it's like he's this great final boss because they both share the same biggest strength, which is the versatility, and that's going to make for an incredible showdown because there's so many pieces both have on the table. But at the same time, it's like defeating him is in a way, yeah, defeating the worst parts of the practice because he gets these people by stealing them. Like, it's, yeah, I love it. It's perfect.
It is good, isn't it? I love the vibe of him as like a, like just him doing his day job and that's why he's here. I just find that so mercenary and different and fun.
Yeah, well, yeah, because that's the other thing. He's not power hungry in the same way so many other people are. He has the power. This is just him doing the same shit. Like for him, this is just, oh, there's probably something here I should either stop or claim or whatever. And that again goes completely against the opposite of Kennet and the Kenneteers, which is like people who are, you know, being oppressed, kind of standing up and caring and fighting for stuff. And he's the opposite. He's like the system, not even actively fighting, just kind of being like pushing back uncaringly.
I
love everything about this.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, that's the end of the chapters. But wait, Elliot, there's an extra material. Should we talk about it for a bit? I mean, as with how we used to discuss these extra materials, a lot of these are very like technical and dense, or not dense in that sense, but just like, you know, there's a lot of info in here and summarizing it, I don't know if anyone wants that. So we just get some notes about knots and depressions, as well as some Avery doodles. One of my favorite parts of this chapter. Chapter of this extra material is a little line near the top where she wrote C-pop modeled for doodles, which I think is just great. A great line to just convey that there was this scene that we can all enjoy in our head of Cherry Pop modeling for these doodles. And I just think that's wonderful.
Well, because like most of this seems to be taking place as Avery is like Skype calling other people to ask their opinions on stuff, as well as summarizing her notes. So you can imagine just like as like she's Skyping next to the monitor, Cherry Pop is like posing for her to doodle as between notes. Yeah, it's great. I mean, yeah, and Avery doodles are always a hit. Like Wabo's ability to inject character into like as you said, this is basically, you know, without all the negative connotation, just an exposition dump or like a lore building dump. Like this almost feels more like, in some ways, these sorts of extra materials are almost more like a pack dice document where it's like, here's all the stuff you'll need to know if you want to run your own knotted place arc in Pack Dice. So it's nice that, bits of character still shine through. Like there's some great banter between Jess and Zed where Jess is like criticizing how Zed handles this stuff and complaining about his airplane analogies. And there is extra character to make it more than just an exposition dump.
Yeah, definitely. That's always makes these things especially fun.
Yeah. But like that said, it's not just like obviously Wobbo would have put this at this point in the story for at least one reason, right? Like you sort of have to take a look at this and be like, okay, what was he thinking? Like why are we being told this?
Mm.
And one of the big things is like obviously we talk a lot about how knots get different rules here. And so I'm wondering, as we enter this final conflict, are we going to start to see the effects of that in Kennet? Like, is Kennet, are there going to be some slight differences to the rules of combat and like the way violence is encouraged or discouraged based on the fact it's been, you know, marinating in Carmine juices for a couple of months?
Mm.
Like, yeah, will karma be on your side if you are just straight up violent? Mm. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. As with all these extra materials, I always try to think about it on a bit of a meta level and think like, okay, why are we getting this? Especially
yeah,
with the fact that this is our first extra material in a while. The thought of, okay, why has Wobbo broken his streak for us to get this? Because obviously, like, some of this stuff is new to us, but some of it feels like we already know at least the general vibes of it. Yeah. The two things that feel important to me are rule changing, as you mentioned, feels strong, especially like, you know, familiar and implement bonds, things like that, like feel especially important as the mosses are our enemies here. But also a fair amount of thought is paid to like digital realms here. Now that Zed and Ray are in town, I think that's probably going to potentially be important. Like the stuff we learned about how they're kind of tangentially pretty similar to paths, at least that stuff feels pretty important to me. I don't know, but we'll have to see, I suppose.
Well, as I said, I took a lot of it to be like, hey, my theory about the wolf dragging the forest river trail in.
Mm.
Like that's how the paths and the collision stuff came into it for me for a bit. Actually, to go to your point about like familiars and implements being important, one thing Toadslaw mentions is that Mist should send the witch hunters in but stay out herself.
Mm.
And my first thought was Mist staying out means they want to activate the barrier with Monty.
Mm.
And we've got that ace in the hole in the barrier, which Charles mentioned, which is it can dampen practice.
Yeah, true. I like that.
So, like, are they just going to be pumping Monty onto the dampening practice? And, yeah, what parts of practice will or won't that affect?
Mm.
Like, yeah, does it weaken familiar things? I kind of almost got the impression that was a more fundamental thing that couldn't be interfered with in the same way.
Mm.
I don't know. I mean, Verona will probably go for it. It'll make everyone else as shit as she is, hopefully.
I'm sure that's something Verona wants.
Yeah, bring everyone down to the same can't really practice level.
Yeah. So that's the end of the discussions for the content this week. But speaking of discussions, we've got our discussion question that we have answers to.
We were asking people, what form would your wolf take? Or what form would another character in a Wobbo Works wolf take?
Yeah. A few people picked other Wobbo Works. We got two different ones that were talking about worm characters.
I mean, what do you expect when you ask about
Of other course, Wobbo, of I course. Suppose? I mean, you know, Vice Versa, I picked Dragon, and I thought gave a really interesting answer. A few of these, I kind of don't want to... Well, one, you know, we're not a worm spoilers show, so I don't want to get into that too much. But both Vice Versa, who picked Dragon, and I'm Easily Impressed, who picked Taylor, gave really great answers, and answers that kind of already felt like they were at least somewhat reflected in Worm as a story.
Yeah.
And so I was just kind of like, man, Wobbo, thinking about flaws of characters and weaknesses and building events around that, it's a good writing strategy.
Yeah, exactly.
The way, clearly leads the way to very interesting stuff.
Yeah, the way he builds his antagonists and shit, yeah, around that, perfect.
Makes a lot of sense.
We got, like, a couple. This was, in a way, a very personal question.
Yes.
And I think maybe overwhelmed a lot of people after the previous discussion question was along the same lines.
Yeah.
We've got a few. Like, we got an answer from Sengachi, which, seemed very personal and sort of talked about, like, you know, real-life stuff with their dad and stuff. So it was like, yeah, like, thanks for sharing stuff like that, those of you who did.
Yeah.
Like, I think Vice Versa touched on some similar stuff as well before diving into Dragon, I think.
Yes. One that definitely made me laugh was Beard of Valor, who gave two answers. But their first answer was, starting out very like, oh, here's how I feel about myself and some of the things about myself. So my wolf could be kind of have these traits. And then at the end of this answer, started giving just a very, very specific example that got so specific that I was just kind of like, oh, this has actually happened, hasn't it? It was just that kind of thing that I found very funny. So good stuff, Peter Bell.
The last answer I very specifically wanted to call out was from Uncle Thermoscales, just because I really liked this idea of basically Uncle Thermoscales said they're a sort of closeted atheist in part of the world where, you know, being Christian is the default. And so, you know, it's one of those, I guess I'd say, brands of Christianity where being an atheist means you must be like an asshole and a terrible person. And so Uncle Thermoscales was like, well, my wolf would probably be like a pastor who doesn't actually like try to live up to the tenets of Christianity, but is one of those, like, you know, I think a lot of us have met people like this in our lives, like somebody who uses Christianity or their religion, I should just say their religion, as a weapon rather than actually like upholding its beliefs and being religious, uses it to build a superiority complex and like use it against other people. And I really liked that sort of idea for a wolf.
Yeah, I agree. A lot of answers, I think Peter Vella's dived into this a little bit as well, of this vibe of like almost the frustration of dealing with somebody who is such a inherent hypocrisy but refuses to acknowledge it, I think is something that hits home for a lot of people. And so having a wolf that plays into that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and I think a wolf who like is centered around that concept of being the one who fits in and rallies others against you feels very powerful.
So thanks everyone for leaving your discussion question answers. It's time for us to give a new discussion question.
So this time let's talk about Charles came up in these last two chapters, and so I think we wanted to ask, how much does Charles have to atone for? And what should his punishment look like?
Yeah, I think you and I even had different reads on this in this very episode. So I'm interested to hear everyone else's thoughts on, how bad did Charles do and what does he deserve?
Yeah, and I know there's been arguments about this on our Discord already as well. So I'm keen to see those sort of come out here. Because, I feel like I definitely have a very different opinion to a lot of people of like how much, like the first half of this question is basically, you know, how much do you think Charles actually did wrong? And I think I seem to be a lot more forgiving of Charles than the average person. So I'm interested to hear, like, for like not just what people think like Charles's punishment should look like where should Charles go from here, but also like I'd be interested to hear how much people seem to think he did wrong, because I feel like everyone actually has different answers for how in the black Charles is, you know, morality rise.
Yeah, I agree. I think everybody has a different read on this, and I'm interested to hear people justify the punishment or lack of punishment they would give to Charles.
So
I guess that's the end of our episode. So if you want to leave your answer to that discussion question, you can do so by putting it in the discussion thread, which we linked in the show notes down below.
Yes. We're also on Twitter at Power Reflect Cast. The live reads are probably going to take a bit of a break coming up. There might be some. They'll probably be inconsistent. I can't promise anything at the moment, but if they are happening and when I do know, that'll be the place to find out.
Yeah. If anything, this should encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter even more, because you'll get to know all the updates on what's going on.
Yeah. And don't forget, we're running that fan art contest. It's about 2 weeks as of this episode coming out that you have to get your art in. So better hustle. I don't know how long a drawing takes people. It'd take me 2 weeks to make something that doesn't look like butt. So Get drawing, painting, sculpting, verbing.
Yeah, cool. There's more info on that on the Doof Media website, doofmedia.com, as well as all the other great shows on the Doof Media Network. Shows which you can support if you become a patron at patreon.com/doofmedia. Get all kinds of bonus content, like our bonus content show, Elliot, that we're going to be recording a new episode and releasing a new episode of pretty soon.
That'll be coming out about 4 days after this one. It's the final movie in the series that we've been talking about on the high ground at the moment. I'm very excited to wrap that series up now.
Yeah, now that we've gotten to the last few Pirates of the Caribbean movies, we're looking forward to the ending of doing
that. But yeah, and as well as just shouting out other Doof shows, What You Say has its big grand finale in the next week or two, I think.
Mm.
So now's your last chance to catch up on all things OC, or do what I do. Just listen to it for Scott and Elise. Don't watch the OC.
Mm. Yeah, you don't need to. You can enjoy the show without watching the OC. In fact, you'll probably enjoy it more because you won't have to have watched the OC.
Exactly.
While you're on Patreon, make sure you check out Wildbo's Patreon as well at patreon.com/Wildbo, because of course we wouldn't have all these great stories without Wildbo being supported by his community. So become part of that community and support him too, or else we'll get you. And that's the end of the show, I suppose.
See you next week.
Bye.